Welcome back to the programme. A caller says every obstacle possible will be put in Marie Steen's way and other candidates who challenge the political and media establishment from standing for president. The system of electing a president in this country is flawed and it only serves to delude voters that they are participating in democracy. Now, I've seen Marie Steen getting an awful lot of, maybe not necessarily in the mainstream media, in inverted commas, but certainly on social media. It'd be very interesting to get her on the show. So we might reach out and see if she's interested in having a chat. I'd like to get to know her views a little better and, tease out what her pathway is. I mean, she's got 10 TDs, hasn't she, already? So that's a halfway there. So it's possible. I don't know. Greg, it's simple. If you have any prosecution against you, you should not be allowed to run. Now, I think I agree with you to some extent. I think prosecutions in that context should lapse. You know, I think if you've had recent prosecutions, it should be a problem. I think everyone's entitled to sort of rehabilitate if they can. Obviously, this very much depends on the crime. But I think, you know, if your prosecution has lapsed or a certain amount of time has passed, would that not be better? A caller said, should someone with no political background be allowed to stand for president? Fianna Fáil selected Jim Gavin, who wasn't even a member of Fianna Fáil at the time. The first rule should be to have some type of public office service. Another caller says, that's the script actually that was given to me earlier. Now, we also had Catherine Connolly on the show. Some of your comments following off the back of that. And more generally about the presidency. The wage for the president is $350k a year, plus travel, plus staff, plus we do not need a president, okay. Another caller says that's exactly the problem. The majority of people did indeed vote this government in, but they're now breaking their promises and ignoring the people's wishes. They claim to have a mandate, but only to do as they promised. If they wish to behave like dictators, then they can expect to be treated with contempt. Another caller says, I'll be voting for Catherine in the election, but she will be sorely missed in the Dáil if she wins. Greg, can you ask Catherine if she genuinely thinks she can achieve more in the Irish than the Dáil chamber? I think from her listening to her comments, I don't think she is looking to achieve the type of things you can as a TD as president. Catherine Connolly claims to be socialist, but like many of her comrades nearing the end of their political career, is prepared to accept and enjoy the dazzling baubles of the ruling elite and as a result making a mockery of their political principles. Catherine won't answer a simple question directly. This is in relation to me asking if she'd be inclined to say, for instance, the question I put to her if you weren't listening, just to get an example, because it comes up all the time and I wanted to get a sense of what candidates actually are going to do in the presidency. So I know she's dead against the removal of the triple lock. So if the government were to proceed with that, it eventually, and the constitution was changed, or the legislation was changed, you know, even though the public didn't have any say in that, and she says she wants to be a president of the people. I was just curious if the document came before her to sign that into law, you know, something she's very opposed to as a TD, would she, and if she believes that it were to go against the constitution, would she refer it to the Supreme Court for further analysis? And her answer when we got to it was along the lines of she would have people look at it, but actually sending something to the Supreme Court means that that's it then, fait accompli, and it doesn't mean it's open to challenge elsewhere. So I don't know exactly what the exact response was, but it was in that space. So the caller says, Catherine won't answer the question directly. I'm waiting to see what ways the wind blows stronger. She won't be getting my vote. She's not up to speed on our constitution. Another reader chat about the presidency in these days of people struggling. Has nobody ever thought of the costs involved in having a president? 3 to 4 million annually, and if that's value for money, plus the costs of running to be elected. Why does the president, or what does the president actually do apart from turn up at Croke Park and other sporting events? It's a complete waste of time and money, this listener thinks. I would like to wish Catherine Connolly the best of luck in the upcoming presidential election, says another. In my humble opinion, she's the only person I would have any faith in. She's a great speaker and doesn't shy away from the truth. Good luck to her. That's what this caller believes. Greg, I'd be worried how Catherine Connolly avoided the question about the triple lock, and maybe that's why Sinn Féin did not row in behind her. Another, I listened to the interview with Catherine Connolly. I've changed my mind on her being a new voice for Ireland. She's made it crystal clear that she will play safe and not rock the boat. And that's just some of them that were coming in there. Thank you, by the way. We really, really do appreciate all of your comments. Now, we had a great guest up here on Friday after the outside broadcast at the ATU, which was lovely. I really enjoyed that. It was great to meet so many people from around the world, so enthusiastic about our beautiful part of the world. But when I come back up, Bernard Harkin was up here. He came up for a chat. Great to meet him. Looked very smart. He had a tweed blazer on. He was looking very smart indeed. And he was up visiting us on Friday. And Bernard lives on his own, but attends Cashlin Core, isn't it? It's not Or, it's Core. It's Cashlin Core. Yeah, someone spelt this wrong. So, or maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong. So, Bernard, it was great to have you up on Friday. And a big hello to all at Cashlin Core. And I believe there's a very special lady called Mary who works in the kitchen, or indeed did. And I believe after 22 years of service, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, after 22 years of service, she retired on Friday. And apparently she's excellent and excellent at what she does and will be a big miss. So two things, Mary, enjoy your retirement, or I'm not sure if you're retiring or just leaving, but whatever happens for you next, whether it's retirement or your next adventure, well done to you, Mary, for so many loyal years at Cashlin Core. A big hello to all the staff there. A big hello to all the people that visit Cashlin Core. And, of course, a very big hello to Bernard. It was great to have you up, Bernard. Great to see you. And I will fulfil my promise to you and hopefully maybe do a show from there sometime into the future. Michael Lynch is in St. Joseph's Hospital in Stranorlar. Hi, Michael. And a big happy birthday to you. Have a wonderful day, Michael. And I'm sure you'll be very well looked after. Lots of love coming in to you from Mum and Dad in St. Johnston.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And as I mentioned a little earlier on, it's just been one of those days where there's been a slew of stories relating to road safety, the rules of the road and their implementation and stuff. So delighted to be able to welcome on to the programme Sean Canny, Minister with responsibility for road safety. Sean, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Good morning, and thanks yourself, and wishing all your listeners the best.
Yeah, great to have you with us. Now, we'll talk about the L drivers in a second, but there's a stat that's republished every now and again, and I still find it flabbergasting, and that's fewer than 6% of drivers hand in licences after disqualification. Now, they're told in the court that they must, yet the overwhelming majority seem to know that if they don't, there's very few, if any, consequences at all. What do you think is actually going on there that 94% of people, even once they've been told to hand in their licence following a disqualification, they don't? How can you explain that? Not you. How can we explain it, you know?
Yeah, I think, first of all, it's disrespect for the courts. The courts have made a decision and the licence should be handed in. I think what we're doing in terms of relating a person's driver's license to the insurance, etc., and the car, that I'd say it will become more difficult with the new rules and regulations for people just to ignore the courts. It is important that they do hand them in, and I will be talking to my colleague Jim O'Callaghan as well to see how we can work together to actually make it an imperative that people do send back in their or hand up their licences when they are disqualified.
Do you think it's the legal profession that are advising people? Because, as I say, how could the information be so... and I don't presume that every one of them that doesn't is actually driving, right? They must want to retain it for other reasons. But someone's giving people the advice at that point to say, you know, you actually don't really need to hand up your licence.
And I would actually say that whilst I don't know who's advising them or whether they're just doing it off their own, making their own decisions. But I think the message loud and clear from me, and I'm sure it'll be from Jim O'Callaghan, that people have got to respect the courts and should hand them their licence, that that is what the courts have decreed. So I'll be looking, as I said, I'll be chatting to Jim O'Callaghan. I'll probably see him at the cabinet meeting on Wednesday, and we'll have a chat about it and see what's the best way we can, with our officials, work to try and make it more less attractive or less easy for people just not to come in with their licences. Yeah. I think it's something that maybe we have to have a system in place where it's actually logged that they do come in or don't come in, and that's probably part of it, that there's probably the records may not be tight enough in terms of making sure that they come in or writing out to them or contacting them.
Another story too, and this could have serious ramifications for drink driving commitments or convictions. Sorry, the Director of Public Prosecutions is set to appeal a significant High Court decision with potential adverse implications for thousands of drink driving prosecutions. Effectively, the chain of custody of blood samples was challenged somewhat successfully, though. There is a window of opportunity here. There'll be a lot of people, a lot of those in the legal profession looking on saying, you know, is this an issue that we can exploit? How concerned are you about that, and what can be done from a legislative perspective to try and make sure that we don't have thousands of people convicted of drink driving back out on the roads?
Well, I think, first of all, There are probably four main causes of accidents on our roads, and one of them is drink and drug driving. So it is a cause for collisions. It does cause deaths, maybe to the person themselves or a member of their own family, or maybe an innocent pedestrian or somebody in some other car. So that's how serious this is. This is not just a test you do. It's actually important that the test has integrity it needs. And look, it's something that is being looked at. If there is additional legislation required, it will be put in place. My role is to encourage the Department of Justice, or if it's my own department, to make sure that we close any of these gaps as quickly as possible. You know, you cannot for 1 minute condone that people who have been convicted of drink driving or drug driving will be back out on the roads because of a technical error. I think it's important that we clean this up as soon as possible, and I will work with the, as I said, with the Department of Justice on that and with my own officials.
Mm, you're going to have a busy conversation with Jim O'Callaghan come Thursday by the looks of things. Learner drivers...
It is interesting, but it's also a fact that Justice and Department of Transport, when it comes to road safety, have a lot of things to work together on.
Of course, yeah.
And we have a road strategy committee, and Jim McCallum, the minister, sits on that committee with me as well. So and I chair it. So basically, we do work together, and we do tic tac on lots of things that are going on within both our departments, which have a common purpose. Absolutely.
I mean, from what I can see, the road traffic legislation is a bit of a basket case. It's a bit of a mess, and we're going to be firefighting these issues all of the while. Would you have concerns that it? You don't know what the reality you could do about it, but it seems a mess, and it seems to be one exploit after the other. And who could blame? You know, a solicitor's got their client's best interests at heart, and laws are proven when they're tested, right? But I mean, would you have concerns that it's like a sieve, the road traffic legislation?
It's not. It's not like a sieve. There may be some technicalities within it that need to be honed in on and strengthen them up. By and large, people who are put off the road wait off the road, and I think that it is important to say that this is all about safety on the road, nothing else. So I think it's important that people understand that there are plenty of laws out there which can be enacted when people drink and drive, and if they're caught, they will be get the appropriate punishment and be penalised appropriately.
There is seemingly, at least in some parts, a culture of driving on your learner permit. There's a lot of reasons for that, not excuses for it, because it's illegal. But, you know, although there has been some good improvements, delays in getting your driving test and, you know, rural transport and stuff, as I say, that's not an excuse to break the law. But, you know, some would argue they're contributing factors. But there are people that sort of, whether they're driving or not, perpetually have a learner driver certificate, and what they've been able to do is as it is to expired and when is required, book a test. They don't even have to turn up for it, and then they can reapply for a learner permit. And there's no doubt learner drivers are overrepresented in, unfortunately, the serious and fatal road traffic collision data. So you are looking to tighten this up significantly, aren't you? Tell us what's on the table.
Well, yeah, just you've described there what's going on, but at the moment there are 65,000 people with a learner permit. They're on their third or subsequent learner permit. We have 14,500 people who are on their 10th learner permit or more. So there is an issue there. At the moment, the rules are if your permit is running out, you apply for a test, you get the test, you get the appointment, and then you are entitled to reapply for your permit. You don't have to sit the test, and at the moment, over 12,000 appointments were not fulfilled in the driving test centres across this country last year. And that's a difficulty where you have tests booked and testers are there to do the test and people don't show up. That has to be sorted out. So my intention is that we will be looking at regulation to actually make sure that after three learner permits, you then will have to sit a test before you'll be given your fourth one or your full licence if you pass the test.
If you fail that test, then you can still apply for another learner permit.
You can. You can, of course.
Does that really fix the problem, though? Because just ask this question, then you can follow on. All that does is take up 35 minutes of someone's time, and they can hit the curb, you know, at the front door of the test centre if they wanted to. Does that really, do you think, prevent what we're talking about here?
Well, what it will do in time is that if you fail your first test, you then can reapply for your permit again, but after three more permits, you have to do your test. And if you fail that test, you'll then have to go back and do your lessons and start off with your theory test again. So that means that after a space of, I think it's probably 7 years, you would be the maximum of which you would actually be able to drive without actually going back and doing the test. The reality of it is that people don't have to do it, they don't do it. And I think it's important that now that we have the testing times back to a reasonable level nationally, that we tidy up all of these other anomalies that are there. And when you think about it, that you have 65,000 people on learner permits on their third or more, there is something wrong, you know, if they haven't set a test to see if they're competent to be on the road.
But the fact that I can hold a learner permit for up to 7 years without ever sitting a test or taking any additional lessons, it's not exactly, you know, coming down with a sledgehammer on this. You know, you're effectively saying the changes will allow someone effectively to have a learner permit in their possession without a test or without further lessons for 7 years. That's a long time. A 23-year-old would be 30.
Well, no, it wouldn't be. No, they would have to set their test after fourth learner permit. And a lot of people here at the moment who are on learner permits, as I said, the 65,000 of them who are on three or more. So the next time, if this regulation is brought in, the next time they go to apply for a test, they'll have to sit the test.
Mm-hmm. Could you have gone a bit tougher on this? Because you talk of an additional 12 lessons. You're talking about additional driving lessons as well. You know, I think for a lot of people, the 12 lessons are box ticking. And they think once they're in the bag, that's it. And they'll either not bother going for the test or keep failing their test, right? There's obviously something seriously amiss there. Do you not think there should be more encouragement for more lessons a bit earlier in the process?
And also, I think that when people do their test, they are given a report on where they were weak in that test. And I think that drivers will be encouraged to actually concentrate on the places or on the manoeuvres or whatever that they're weak in, so that they become more competent to drive on the road and become safer on the road. Because at the moment, if you fail a test, it means you're not supposed to be driving the car without having a qualified driver with you.
No, of course.
I don't know if that's happening in all the cases, and that is a problem. So we have, you know, there's a tidy up to be done on all of this, and it's also making the driver testing centres the testers themselves sitting there waiting for somebody to come in doesn't show up, and you have 12,000 events like that in a year. It's making the whole thing inefficient as well. So it's going to take a bit of time to resolve these issues, but I think that the message is loud and clear. People will have to test, do their driving tests in order to remain driving. Otherwise, if they repeat it, failure after two rounds, they will have to go back to
basic. I think you had an opportunity here. I think the truth be told, there's no one with a learner driver for 5, 6, 7 years who's only driving with someone sitting beside them. Do you know what I mean? I don't know a single person that would commit to doing that for me or with me. Do you know that sort of a way?
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, the people who are driving without a qualified person with them, are they insured? Legally, they shouldn't be on the road, but are they insured? And that is another issue. So we have to delve into this and make sure that when the regulation is brought in and the detail will be brought forward, that it's effective. It actually encourages people to take the test and also to be prepared for the test. It's not just something you do, fail it, and then you keep going. That there will be further consequences if you fail it a second time.
And maybe there's a cultural change effect that comes through with something like this, that we just realise that, no, this is how you do it. And those who have been consistently ignoring it, you know, they move on, or they actually conform to the law, but new generations perhaps see a different system. Okay, we'll see. Thanks, Sean. Appreciate your time. That's Minister Sean Canny there. He's got responsibility for road safety. Do you think that goes too far? Do you think it goes far enough? Is it a missed opportunity? Have they struck the right note? Let me know. 086 60 20 5000. Greg, in other countries on a disqualification, your license is invalid. You have to apply for a new license to get back driving when the period expires. No need for nonsense like this in Ireland. Thanks, Daniel. Right, okay. I'm not sure of the status of someone's license on disqualification. Do you hand it up like for storage, like a kid might a mobile phone at the start of the school day, or is it invalid? I don't know. If people had to resit their test after 12 points and lost their license for a year, we'd have safer roads. Well, you're off the road, aren't you, after 12 points? But yep, interested suggestion, add in resitting the test there. Another, let's face facts, many don't hand in their license when they are disqualified, and there's no follow-up to ensure it happens. 94% of people don't. A caller said, I did my test 4 times before I passed. It's nerves. They got the better of me. So because I'm a nervous person, I'll have to pay more. Is that fair? Or, and I've great sympathy for you, or is sort of controlling your nerves, especially, say, for instance, then if you go to drive in Dublin or on a busy motorway, is that not in some way part of the test of your driving ability as well? If you find that nerve-wracking, might your nerves play a factor in a crisis situation when driving? I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not saying that's the case. I've great sympathy for you, and I understand exactly what you're talking about. Soon there'll be no roads with water flooding, overgrown, which is a big safety issue. 3 weeks in, very little done between farmers, landlords, etc. The president's role is nothing more than a meet and greet role to heads of state. It's nothing more than being a hotel concierge. Surely there's more to that. Right. One of the big issues on the roads as well is scooters. And I think scooters have a place in modern society, okay? It gives people the ability to get from point A to point B. They're not always cycling. You know what I mean? They're not using their physical energy. The law is this. Scooters shouldn't be on footpaths. They shouldn't be going down the right way in footpaths. They shouldn't be going up the wrong way in footpaths. They should be on the road. Now, they should have lights. They should have no seat. You shouldn't be carrying anything. There's lots of rules and regulations in relation to them. You shouldn't be exceeding 25 kilometres per hour. Those are the laws. You don't need to wear a helmet. So that's not part of it. But there's a big problem with scooters on footpaths in different places. Katrina O'Donnell is owner of Katrina's Hair Salon in Letterkenny and is with us now. Katrina, you've been speaking about this. You've got your concerns. What's the lived experience? You're on the main street in Letterkenny. Am I right, Katrina?
Good morning, Greg. Yeah, indeed I am. Yeah, just at Lower Main Street.
Yeah, I know the place. Yeah. So what's the lived reality then? Cause especially with your clients stepping in, off, and especially out and onto the footpath of a main street?
Yeah, we do have quite a clear view of the Lower Main Street there, with just the big windows and stuff. So going out, you know, we're fairly aware of what's going up and down the street, but you could never be ready for a bike, even the bikes as well, Greg, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's just not the scooters. So they are using the footpath for the scooters and the bikes. So that's a massive problem.
And is it the lack of noise? Is it the speed? Is it, you know, the shared space?
Not the speed.
The speed.
That's big. Yeah.
Okay. Have you had any near misses, or are you just trying to get the message out there before there is a serious issue?
No, we actually had a situation at a year past July there, and one of our customers, and she wasn't an elderly lady, she was a young lady, and she stepped out, and it was actually a mountain bike.
Mm.
So it wasn't an electric scooter. I know a lot of people didn't think at the time. I was actually on Highland Radio.
Yep, I remember.
So, it was awful. It was traumatic for everybody, actually, for the lady herself, and for the young person too that was riding the bike. It was terrible. Just not a nice situation to be in, and even for our own staff and the customers. It was a busy morning. So, but it was just the noise of the impact on the ground, the bang that it made when it happened. It was just there was she had no chance.
Yeah.
No chance at all.
And I know she was injured, and it did affect some travel arrangements for her, but it could have been much more serious. These are, the impact of the weight of the vehicle, but the weight of the person against someone who's not braced for it. We know the potential consequences here, Katrina.
Yeah. And it's just, I know it was well highlighted at the time, and it's a talking, it's a conversation every day. And especially in with us, because we have the view and we see it like so many times every day. And it's just so, at this stage, we're walking people to the door. Mm. If that doesn't happen, you're shouting at somebody going out the door, just make sure, look up, look down. And they do. And, our customers are so aware, but you're nervous of people going out.
So would you see...
Coming in is not a problem because...
Yeah, of course.
They have the view.
Yeah. But are you seeing sort of, two or three bikes or scooters a day? Is it one a week?
Not at all. At least. Yeah,
okay.
At least a couple every day. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And both instances, whether it's a bike or it is a scooter, it's illegal, right? But there seems to be little or no enforcement of either the bike or scooter regulations. Very frustrating, that, because where is the discouragement for someone?
Yeah, well, this is it. I suppose we've been doing our own little bits of research of where you stand. Now, coming in, signage even for it, so coming in at Ballymacool on the entrance from the Glenties Churchill side,
mm-hmm.
there's a sign just near Charles Kelly's. Coming onto Ballymacool Road there, there's a signage, no cyclists on the pathway. It's quite high up on a pole. I suppose I'm more aware of it now after what happened to us, but there's very little signage. That's the only one that I'm aware of. Now, there could be more around the town, but because it's our way into town, I'm aware of that signage. But it's quite high up. I don't know if the cyclists would even notice it, but I do think there should be more signage, more awareness. And, we're even fine when somebody is going past on their bike or on their scooter. You could say something to them, but you're almost afraid to say anything to you as well, because you can get spoke back to too, and we don't know all the legality of it either. So, that's concerning.
All right, okay. Listen, thanks for helping us get the message out there. I do appreciate it. So cyclists, people on scooters, they must do everything that regular road users do to an extent. Stop at traffic lights when required. Stop at pedestrian crossings and zebra crossings. Stop at cycle traffic lights wherever you see those. Stop at stop signs and yield the right of way at yield signs. Of course, avoid cycling or scooting on motorways. You must use a cycle lane in a pedestrianised area where an appropriate one is provided. Otherwise, you don't really need to use them. Where the cycle lane is a contraflow cycle lane, allowing cyclists to go into the opposite direction to the traffic on the one-way street, you can only cycle in the contraflow direction. But other than that, you're out on the road. There are fixed charge penalties as well. You shouldn't be cycling on the footpath or scooting on the footpath. here is the regulations. You're not allowed to cycle on a footpath unless there's a designated cycle lane on the footpath for you, or you're entering or exiting a property. Cycling on a footpath is not a specific fixed charge offence, though, which is the problem, I think. However, you could be fined for doing so if a guard had deemed their cycling to be without reasonable consideration. So you're not allowed to cycle on a footpath, but there is not actually, or scoot on it, a specific fixed charged offence for it, which is a problem, I think. Thanks, Katrina. Kevin, you've got experience of this as well. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. What was your and your wife's, I believe, and dog's interaction with a person on a scooter recently?
Oh, well, it's been... the first time it happened, I actually was on the radio to you about it and had reported it to the guards. The thing is, it's happened another twice that she's been nearly knocked over on the footpath. And you don't hear them coming, and they're coming at a speed. And then they actually think of an entitlement just to clip you and carry on. You know, and the thing about it is, Greg, somebody will be seriously injured.
Well, they have been, you see. We're lucky, Kevin, maybe locally it hasn't happened, but around the country it has. Exactly what you're warning of, unfortunately, has happened, where people on scooters have been in collision with pedestrians, and, you know, the scooter, in some cases, the scooterist has suffered serious injury or loss of life, but the person they've hit's also been killed as well, like, so... I just want to clarify something about the rules, Kevin, and then tease things out with you. It's very specifically against the law to cycle a scooter on the footpath. You're not allowed to use footpaths, pedestrian areas, or motorways. You can't hold a mobile phone. You can't have a seat on your scooter, and you can't carry passengers or goods. Now, I think you might get away with a backpack, but you can't sort of hang your shopping on the bars, so to speak. But you cannot, according to the law, use an e-scooter in a pedestrianised area or on a footpath. You contacted the guards in relation to this, Kevin. Did you have any satisfaction?
No. All I was told was that there'd be a patrol car in the area and we'll keep an eye out.
Mm.
You know, I was speaking to a councillor since that as well, and I put the same thing to the councillor. I said, look, we're the enforcement on the street.
Mm.
And the councillor said, well, when I approach them, they say the bigger fish is to fry.
Well, like,
if you don't have... Things are happening in Letterkenny Main Street. And it's been well publicised over this last month, 2 months, right? But unless we have a presence of our law enforcement on the street, I did use this before flippantly, that it's like Dodge City, right? But we need to get some kind of control handle on what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And these minor infringements, as you were led to believe that they're minor infringements, need to be nipped in the bud.
Yeah.
Because minor infringements leads to larger infringements.
I think too, I think you're sort of wrapping up a few different issues, but all of those issues have the same sort of solution, and that's a greater guard of presence on the main street. And I will say, you know, like, I have no problem going into Letterkenny Main Street. I do recognise where there are issues. The bottom line is I think there is a window of opportunity. You know, Letterkenny's got nicknames, whether they're right or wrong. People are chatting outside of Letterkenny about whether or not they'd go in there, or they'd discourage their family members to go in there. I think what the people of Letterkenny, especially the powers that be, need to realise is that there is a window of opportunity here to make, you know, to make Letterkenny feel safe. Kevin, do you know what I mean? And I think that window potentially is closing, and then we'll start hearing big time from the businesses. But I think that that window is still there, and they need to get their acts together, I think, in terms of people feeling safe and getting these vehicles off the footpaths as well.
They have to clamp it down. Like, I mean, they're going to have to turn around and say, look, we're going to allot 2 guards 5 days a week, 6 days a week, until they get it into people's head that you can't do this. I remember back a couple of years back, one guard stood at the Box Junction at the old courthouse. There wasn't one person went on the Box Junction or jumped a red light.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
I know, I do,
that's
yeah.
proven.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and there'd probably be less, less abuse
on the street,
of disabled
people
parking.
People will heed them.
Yeah, less abuse of disabled parking as well, less loitering. You know, the stuff that makes people feel... You know, feel okay, right, Kevin? Listen, it's got to the point now whereby your wife is experiencing these instances to the point whereby, I presume she's not enjoying her walks like she should be able to.
No, she's not, because you don't know what's coming behind you, because there's no noise out of them.
Yeah,
Back in my day, there was a bell on your bike. Now there's nothing. There's no noise. There's no nothing.
Yeah. Well, your bike and scooter are supposed to have a horn of some description, but they shouldn't be on the they shouldn't be on the footpaths one way or other. So that's even if they made a noise, they're not supposed to be on the footpath. It's against the law.
No, they're not supposed to be on the. Definitely. Yeah. And the sooner they get them off, look, it's very simple. To come up the main street means. They're going against the flow of traffic, the one-way system, and this is all, there is no logic in what they're doing. And they know they can get away with it. And it's simple and straightforward as that.
Kevin,
if
thank
I went
you.
Down the street on the footpath and the car, I'll guarantee you wouldn't get 20 yards.
No. You wouldn't, of course. Thanks, Kevin. That's Kevin there. Have you got similar experiences or similar views? I don't think, because it's against the law as well, and I know this is not just Letterkenny, I think I've certainly spoken to people in Buncrana that have an issue with this. What's the story in Ballybofey, Stranorlar? You know, then you go to the likes of Donegal Town where it's circular and the road's laid out a different way. I would say there's probably not a big an issue there. I think when you got long main streets, I don't know what the story's in Glenties, for an example, Dunlow would be a challenge. I'm trying to think of other parts of the county with long footpaths and stuff. But anyway, you can help me out on this. Is this a problem in your area as well? What should we do? Are we still talking about having guards on the street of Letterkenny or any of our streets for that matter? It's very hard to imagine. I'm not going to make any friends with this, but it's very hard to imagine that there isn't one or two people every day that could go out onto the streets as part of their duties. Maybe one and a community guard or something. You know, you don't have to do anything either, really. Just because we're not even getting into the dark mornings and the dark nights properly yet, and this is going to exacerbate the problems. But there has to be a solution that is great PR for the guards, etc., but also actually changes people's behaviour. Because we need to change people's behaviour. At the moment, it's fine, because you're not going to get done. You're not going to get into trouble. So you keep doing it, right, until such time as you think, right, I could get into bother here. I don't know. What do you think? And I want to hear from what it's like wherever you're listening. I don't know if you're listening in Derry or Strabane as well. Is a particular problem there? Is the issue dealt with differently there? Towns and villages across the region, is this a big problem for you or specific to some of the cases I've certainly heard of in Letterkenny and to a somewhat lesser extent, but still significantly in Buncrana as well? Comments on our last topic there. Why don't they bring back a Garda foot patrol? Yeah, I think a lot of people would welcome it. The only thing is that the Gardaí aren't the solution to everything, and people think the Gardaí are. But I mean, suppose ultimately the guards have to enforce the law. That is the principal role, isn't it? So I'd like to know, Greg, does this apply to a mobility scooter? Surely not. No. Mobility scooters are treated the same, as wheelchairs and what have you, aren't they? Let me just double check. Because it's a good question, and I will get the answer for you, because that's what we try and do. Yes, you can use a mobility scooter on a footpath in Ireland, providing you stay within the legal permitted speed limit of 4 miles per hour. Larger mobility scooters with higher top speeds can be used on roads or in cycle lanes, but they can't go over 9 miles per hour on the road and must not be used on footpaths. So actually, the interesting thing of that is that it's legal to drive a mobility scooter on the regular roads. But on a footpath, the speed limit's 6.4 kilometres per hour. Users must take responsibility, care for their own safety and the safety of others on the public road. Mobility scooters must be considered medical devices, not vehicles for sale, to avoid tax and insurance requirements. So you obviously you need to have a medical reason for having one. There's no differentiation between self-propelled and powered wheelchairs, mobility scooters in the law. So, as I suspected, they're treated the same as wheelchairs. Could the County Council not write on the footpath that no scooters or bikes are allowed? Somebody would be badly injured. I've had a few near misses myself. We can't keep talking about these near misses, folks, because someone's going to get seriously hurt. You have as much chance in this of keeping scooters off the pavement in this country or this county as you have of keeping drunk drivers off our roads. No enforcement means no chance. But the majority of people don't drink and drive. It's a tiny, tiny minority. Let's get that tiny minority that use scooters on the footpaths off. We can't throw our hands up and give in, can we? Hi, Greg. Why do the majority of people on scooters always wear black? A very good question. And I've seen them in the piddling rain and at half dark heading up the road here on a scooter, and this tiny red light, and I'm thinking, seriously, you know, are you just rolling the dice on life? It doesn't seem to make sense. All right, keep them coming in. That's quite a busy topic.